You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. My guest today is Paulette Rico, and we talk about divorce. So divorce is not a new thing, but it can still bring up lots of different emotions in a wide range of people for all kinds of reasons. Paulette shares the story with us of how her divorce experience changed literally every single part of her life. We talk about the marriage. We talk about how they got to the point of divorce. So many people listening to this will have their own personal stories of divorce to compare this to and relate it to. Others listening might be wondering if someday divorce is in their future. And there are probably even people in the audience who are watching and listening who are at the stage of hoping for marriage, planning for marriage, or new in relationships that they hope last forever, right? This story has something to offer everyone because Paulette's divorce was a lot, folks. It was just all kinds of a lot. So, are you ready to meet Paulette? I think you are. Let's do it. Paulette Rico, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm happy you're here today. Are you ready for a fun chat?
I am. I'm excited, always.
Yay. All right. I start all my conversations asking my guests, what part of the world are you and where do you call home today?
Well, I'm originally from Boston. Then I lived in Belize for 3 years, but now I call Atlanta home.
All right. You've bounced around and we're going to learn more about that, I think, in a minute. So next question, what is your favorite way to transition from a busy time to downtime?
Well, I have two, but my favorite would be to go down the hall, outside, go out in the backyard, walk out to the dock, and go out on the boat and jump in the lake.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I love that. Out on the boat, into the middle of the lake, jump in. That sounds great. All right. Topic of the day, not how wonderful it is to live by a lake, but surviving high conflict divorce, specifically yours and how your divorce changed the course of your life. So I want to just say that I'm sure that there's a lot of people who are listening who have their own divorce stories that they compare yours to. And so that's why this will hopefully be a very inspiring and helpful story for many, many people to hear. We're going to talk about the details of your divorce. Whenever I talk to people about dissolving their marriage, I like to actually back up and talk about the start of the relationship first, because it puts everything in context, what kind of situation we were ending. So where did you and your ex first meet?
Well, I was 17. That should say a lot.
You were young.
I was young. I just turned 17. I was at a nightclub with my older sister.
Okay.
I don't quite know how I got in, but it was 1981, and they didn't really card people back then. I was 5'8" and acted, and you know, I think the drinking age was 18 or 19 or 20 at the time. So, yeah, somehow I snuck in with my older sister. They carded her and not me, and I was there. She was home visiting for the weekend, and he asked me to dance to "You Shook Me All Night Long."
Okay.
DC. Before I knew it, we were dating.
Very, very nice. Those were different times. Those were different times when they didn't card everybody that came in the door. And I love the way you reflected back and you're like, this definitely happened, but I will admit I don't understand how. Don't understand how I got in the nightclub. I don't understand why anybody was letting me in that nightclub, but it definitely happened.
It did. It was a cold night. I remember standing in line thinking, and I had braces.
Yeah.
And I was terrified to smile. So, you know, I gave one of these smiles if you're, you know, like.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have
right,
one of
couldn't
those.
Show my teeth, right?
Yep.
Yep.
That's every. Yep. Every picture of me in high school.
Too young to be here, but you know, I also was taught as a young woman to just always act like I knew where I was supposed to be there. And when you act like you're supposed to be somewhere, you know, magic happens. So.
That is that and holding a clipboard in your hand. Those are two ways to look like you belong. Exactly. So you're young. You meet him at a nightclub and having a good time. You date, you get married. How long was this marriage?
21 years.
21 years, that's a very long marriage. Okay, that's, I mean, listen, I have what I think is a reasonable concept of the permanence of relationships, and 20 years is a long time. So, all right. So, I have had the fortune to talk to many people who have had what I will call civil separations. I don't think I've ever met anybody who would say that they enjoyed the process of getting a divorce. Even if you are nice to the people, and even if it goes in the very, very best way, the process itself of separating after you've been together for even a short amount of time is complicated, tedious, unpleasant, even on the best of the days. So the little I know about your divorce that you gave me on the intake form, it does sound like this was quite an ordeal. So share with us some of the high points of the length and process that it took you, that you guys were involved in going in dissoluting, dissolving this relationship.
Well, I came from a background where growing up Catholic, we weren't just to talk about divorce. Divorce was sort of a taboo. There was quite a stigma. My grandmother had divorced my mother's father when my mother was 6 months old, I was told. I didn't meet him till I was 15. That's a whole nother 15,000-hour podcast. So I always had this vision that divorce was quick and simple, right? She did eventually get remarried when my mother was 14, and that's a whole nother 9,000-hour discussion. But so you come into a divorce with a story, is my point, right? My father's parents stayed married because he died at 50. So, that's easy. I
She
believe,
laughs. She laughs. The reason this
right?
was
I mean,
easy
just
is death.
yeah. When they're dead, you can't divorce them. So, and I'm not pro-divorce, everyone. Deep breath. I'm not by any means. I love marriage. I love life. I love connection and relationships, but it is a fact of life and it's a $50 billion industry, and don't get me started. But so I came into this marriage with good intention. I was 17 when we met, 22 turning 23 when we married. He was 24 turning 25. I thought dating 7 years was, plenty of time, right? My father was an intellectual and insisted I graduate from college. My mother was a ballerina and was devastated that I wanted to go to college, wanted me to go right into a tutu and a rhinestone tiara. So we dated through the college thing. I had actually had a boyfriend when I met him. He told me to break up with him. I did. So it took a few months, but that was a long distance relationship from the summers. But I found myself embroiled, engaged in this very large family, and it consumed my life. I came from a very small family. My mother was an only child. I had no cousins on that side. My father only had one brother, so I had four cousins. We saw them, at Thanksgiving, that kind of thing. So I didn't really have this large extended family. My family was my mother's business. She owned a ballet studio, and I literally, not figuratively, grew up in a ballet studio. So I knew hundreds of young girls and, of course, friends at school and all that. But I really just had this fantasy that getting married was something on my checklist of things to do. So he was the first one to ask. He didn't actually ask, he told me to marry him. It was more like a command. He just said, marry me. I won't tell you how I responded. It's a G-rated, it's a, well, it was a sarcastic 1980 something to say. It was pouring rain and we were walking out of a restaurant and he handed me a box and said, marry me. And I said, I never really responded when we got to the car. He said, well, aren't you going to call your parents? So I did. And I said, he asked me to marry him. And they were like, oh, yay. So I thought, oh, well, they're all really excited. I think I'm supposed to be really excited too, right? And I was very overwhelmed, confused. But I was, Graduating from college, and I had that pretty little piece of paper, saying that I was a college graduate and didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life. But it was on my list of things to do. So bought a pink wedding dress. I looked like Glinda the Good Witch. I had strawberry blonde hair and a very big puffy pink dress. I came down in my little bubble, literally, like the wedding. I mean, like the Glinda, from the Wizard of Oz, everyone, if you're like, who the hell is Glinda? So so I walked down the aisle, and as I remember my father saying to me, Paulette, when you walk down this aisle, you're going to be Mrs. Fill in the blank. And I said to him, I know, Dad. Not, I know, isn't that like I felt defeated.
So
And I was
you
too afraid to speak my
to
mind.
speak up. All right, so there's a lot to unpack there. So the origin story that you have, you grew up in a household with faith, Catholic faith, where the presumption is that people get, even today in 2025, the doctrine of Catholicism is that you marry once, you stay married until death. One of my jokes that I have when I'm talking to people about divorce is you don't need to ask your priest what he thinks about divorce. You know, it's hard-coded into the rules of the religion, right? It's like we don't
Bingo.
know, right? We know that he doesn't prescribe it. So you grow up with that message, but I think it's really common. Your wedding sounds like it could be a scene out of Wedding Singer, the movie with Adam Sandler, just based on the timing, the 1980s, that kind of thing. So I think that's a brilliant sort of thing. But you talk now, more than 20 years in the future, about some things that sound like a power disparity between you and your then boyfriend. He was telling you were getting married. He told you to break up with your boyfriend, and that you didn't feel like you could speak up even on the wedding day. The first question I have about that is, do you think that you were aware actually at the time that you had those feelings, or is that something you see looking in the rearview mirror? Because I have been married, and one of the things that happens is that it is confusing and it is overwhelming, but it's hard to decipher in the moment because people tell you that that's going to happen. Like, so in a good, not so good, great, crappy situation, the same description can be there.
I broke up with him when we were I think I had just turned 20. And because I felt I wasn't ready to get married, and I had had a relationship, I would call it a weekend dalliance, as my therapist called it, with my sister's husband's cousin at Thanksgiving. And I thought, oh, there's more to life. Maybe I'm not meant for this person. And I'm still in college, and I was studying journalism, working in TV, radio, media, teaching dance part-time, working at a radio station, and kind of enjoying life, but still, young. And I was modeling part-time and kind of living the 20-year-old life. And so I remember getting off the train from New York, and he picked me up, and I had to be honest with him. I said, I think I'm not ready to be in a relationship. There might be someone else. And we ended up getting back together. And again, how much time do we have? But so it was a confusing time in my life, where 80% of me knew it was wrong, but 20% of me knew I didn't have a choice. I wasn't the type of person, woman, young girl, to break the mold. I let everyone else make my decisions for me, because if they didn't work out, I wouldn't be to blame. It felt as if having other people make my decisions for me meant that it was easier, that I would be accepted and loved and cherished and honored and worshiped. And just it would be easier and smoother sailing to go with the flow, instead of creating that. I really don't want to be whatever. I didn't even know what I wanted at that point. It was very confusing. There was a part of me that knew I needed something different, but I didn't have the confidence and self-awareness to verbalize that.
I think it's interesting. One of the parallels is, or one of the The through lines that I see as someone who's way outside of your story is the connection to your mom and the ballet and the ballet studio. Because ballet is art and it's considered expression, it's also very rigorous and there is a set formula to follow. It's like, this is the way we do this. And
That's
then, you
correct,
know,
yeah.
and so that I can see how there would be a very strong message of the path to success is doing what you are told to do the best way you can do it.
Well, it was even deeper than that, though, Amy, because when you grow up in a family where your grandmother is Pauline and your mother is Paulette and your father is Paul, and you have two sisters that are much older than you that are Pauline and Paula, but yet you are called Paulette Jr. and the business is Paulette's Ballet Studio, you are now the golden child and you are personified, and your entire reason for existing is to keep the legacy of the Paul Paulette, Pauline Paula Paulette thing. So at the age of 4, I was called, Little Paulette, and it eventually became Paulette Jr. when I became taller than the other people in the family. So there was a legacy element. And every day when I would see that on the marquee going to the studio, I'd be like, oh, okay, I guess that's my destiny. Now, I loved to dance. I happened to be okay at it. I was, never going to be, in the New York City Ballet or Joffrey. I'm built like Marilyn Monroe, not an anorexic ballerina. So, hence modeling worked and dance was not really my thing. When I put on pointe shoes, I was 6'1". So, and male ballerinas are 5 foot something and a size negative zero. And I was a 4 or 6 and, voluptuous. So it didn't really match my persona nor my personality. But the message was never let them see you sweat. The show must go on and be a trooper. And
Okay, so that shows
always,
up in your marriage.
always. I wore, I put on my lipstick, and I entertained and I gave really good hugs and wrote wonderful thank you notes and loved to cook and clean and diaper babies. And I realized, wait, how did I get here? My summary that I talk about in my book, which I don't talk about so much, but I do discuss this song by Talking Heads, and it's there's a where David Burns is speaking in his very foreboding, eloquent voice with the resonance to it. This isn't my beautiful house. This isn't my beautiful wife. How did I get here? I don't have his voice, so I just butchered it. But listen to the song, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah, it's called Once in a Lifetime.
I
So,
think I had the
yeah.
lyrics to that wrong in my head. So he says, "This isn't my beautiful house." I always said, "This isn't my beautiful life." He says, "Wife."
He says wife, yeah.
I totally, you know how that thing is
Well,
that you can listen to
now you're
lyrics and
making me
can.
question it, Amy. I heard wife. It could very well be life. I'm not changing his lyrics, but I interpreted that. And I remember it being in my minivan getting the mail across the street. And I always listened to the radio on full blast, being a dance teacher. My kids were like, oh my God, mommy always listens to the music so loud because I was always choreographing dances in my head while I was dancing. And I would pump the brakes to the beat. And I was a fun mom, I was always like, good dance. They would always say, drive crazy, mom. And I would do the steering wheel like the music. And, I was a fun mom, a little too fun sometimes. But so I remember hearing that. And they weren't in the car when this memory happened. I think I dropped them off at school. I was coming back from the grocery store. And I could hear him with the speakers as I crossed the street. And I heard him say it as I'm looking at the house. And it was just terrifying. Like, how did I get here?
So that experience of the waking up in a situation where you question how you got there is something that is it shows up a lot in the stories of transformation and choices that I get to share. And it can happen for a variety of reasons where something happens that gives you the chance to reflect on. It's like, whoa, this is not I thought what I thought I was building. But I think that one of the things, so let's regroup. You build a life together. So you graduate with a degree in journalism, you are building a career, you become a dance teacher.
Yes, I was in the dorm sophomore year, and the phone rang, and my mother always started every sentence with, "Would you be good enough?" Or sometimes, "Would you be a dear?" But the sentence went something like, "Would you be good enough to sub Penny's classes for her while she's out on maternity leave?" And she used to teach three jazz classes on Tuesdays, a 4:30, a 5:30, and a 6:30. And I said, "Well, I've got a class on Thursday afternoon. It would be really hard for me to get there in time." She goes, "Well, call your teacher, see if you can change it." So 20 years later, I was still there. And I don't do anything half-assed if I'm going to do it. So I helped her grow the business from about 150 students back in 1982 to when I left in 2002.
Okay.
I finally put up my, I said, "I love you, but I can't do this anymore." Yeah, so I wasn't a conscious decision, but yes, I went from teaching three classes a week to 21 years co-directing and basically running the business with her.
So this is really interesting because you were on one path and then you really were in a position where you allowed other people to direct you into these parts of your life that you had almost stepped out of. And so that is really interesting. But you do build a life. You are married for 20 years. You mentioned that there are children, so you have children.
We did.
You step into what you describe as a big family, and you say that running the house and being the wife and the mother in that family was consuming. And it can be, right? It's an enormous amount of work to run a household, something that people really, really don't necessarily understand, especially if you come from something that's a small family. You have no concept of how much work it is.
Yeah, I didn't mind the work. I'm a
Right.
very hard worker. I never say die, never say quit, and I do everything full throttle. It's just I'm an enthusiastic person. I embrace life wholeheartedly. But it wasn't the work, it was the resentment that I slowly bubbled up when I felt that it was an obligation
Yeah.
and it was expected and there was no it just felt like, wow, if I didn't do this or live this type of expectation, what would happen? There wasn't a lot of collaboration or congruent goal
Yeah.
seeking. It was expected.
So you use the word resentment. I think resentment is a really, really interesting thing because resentment shows up like anger. Feels like anger, but deep down underneath, it's almost always rooted in unmet desires. Like, so
Oh,
resent,
absolutely.
yeah, resentment grows when we're not doing something or being heard about something that is, that we crave. And so it's a confusing situation to be in because we direct our resentment sometimes very off frequently out towards other people. Like that, and what sometimes it requires is looking in and saying, wait a minute, what is the thing that's not being met here? What am I not getting to do? What is not happening? All right. So, without getting too personal, share with us some of the things that led to the divorce. To be together 20 years, this is something that confuses people a lot of times. They're like, well, if you were together 20 years, why didn't you just stay together forever? Like, what were some of the things that tipped the scale that you guys were like, no, this has to stop? We do not, we're not good together.
Well, my whole life felt like it wasn't my life. I felt like I was being an actress, and I was pretty good at it. Even my best friend said I had no idea.
Yeah.
And I knew I had to quit the job and remove myself from the relationship, but I couldn't do both things at the same time. And I said to myself, which one will be easier? Which one will give me greater courage muscles to be able to do the harder? So I decided to quit the job first. That was a difficult thing. A friend of mine, Paula, who passed away, I remember she said, "What's new?" I said, "Oh, I quit my job." And she said, "Wait, you quit your mother?"
Right,
Realized,
because it's a family
yeah,
business,
I
yes.
kind of did. Anyway, she's passed away of breast cancer. God rest her soul. But so I remember that conversation, and it was a big revelation for me. But that 6 years between quitting the job and then filing for divorce did allow me, and I had umbilical hernia surgery. And that umbilical hernia surgery happened in October and 6 weeks, September, and then I quit in October. And that 6 weeks on the couch allowed me The privacy, the solitude, the self-study to realize that if I did not make a change in my life, it would be bad. I was very depressed. I would even say suicidal. I felt lost. I didn't feel angry. I felt very melancholy, reminiscent, nostalgic. I wanted my life back. I wanted to start over. And I realized if I didn't change something in my life, I'd be 95 years old and resentful. Or I'd drive my car off the bridge. I was really thinking about escapism. How do I get out of this trap that I have created? It was completely my fault. And I started to take, I didn't blame anyone else. I mean, there were times that I'd be like, oh my God, they talked me into this. And then I said, yeah, but I acquiesced and agreed. I did not know the word no. I did not have the word no in my vocabulary. I never said no to anyone for any reason. I just said, yep, absolutely. Don't worry about it. I got you covered. I'll teach that class. I'll make those costumes. I'll host Christmas. I'll do whatever I needed to do just to get through it. So that 6 years gave me the courage to file for divorce. The first mistake I made was to trust my spouse to do the right thing. I went back to my grandmother divorcing her husband, and I thought, well, it was easy for her. She just went down to the courthouse, filed for divorce, and I mean, I don't know the ins and outs of what happened in 1929 or 27. But I'm sure it wasn't as easy as she painted. So yes, I did finally get the courage to file for divorce. We ended up in an 8.5 year fully litigated divorce case that included a 12-day trial. The 12-day trial took place over 9 months. I assumed if there would be a 12-day trial, and by the way, they never tell you that if it were, it would be Monday to Friday, Monday to Friday, and Monday, Tuesday. But no, it doesn't happen that way. It happens over a very long period of time, which also leads to more convoluted, evil, manipulative game playing. But prior to that, though, I just assumed that we'd go through the normal mediation discovery process and come up with a settlement agreement, but it was not the case. Of course, there was 2 years of preparation to even get to the beginning of the trial. As I mentioned, all the normal, boring, traditional, forgive the word, normal discovery process, plaintiff, defendant, lawsuit, discovery, domestic relations, financial affidavit, and all the normal, documentation that is required of the law. Of course, I didn't even know that was required. I thought, gosh, this is so c complicated and, judicial and legal and ugh, icky. No one killed anyone. Like, what's the big deal, people? Like, let's move on with it. But I was very fortunate to have been connected to it, a very experienced family law attorney through my father's financial advisor. When I went to him and I said, I think this is going to be tough. He goes, I know who you should call. And my father had passed away. So it was kind of the way of my father sending me this message. And my mother's maiden name was Martin, and my attorney's name was Martin, his first name. And I thought, this is something hugely karmic. And then my great grandmother's name was Regina, and my ex-husband's attorney's name was Regina. So I thought, I can't. There's some interesting layers of karma here. Then of course the judge made his decision, which took an additional 9 months. I didn't know a judge could take 9 months to deliberate a family law issue, but he did. And then once the judge made his decision, my ex-husband did not like the judge's decision. So he appealed it on 17 counts, which went an additional 4 years in state appellate Supreme Court. So for about 8.5 years, call it a decade, my life was monopolized by the judicial legal system. I learned more than I knew was even possible. I took copious notes while I was in court. I wanted to learn everything about the judicial legal system and family court. I did learn the hard way that it is a $50 billion industry.
A
Watch
divorce is a,
the documentary Divorce Corp, like corporation, if you were at all curious about that. And it's an old documentary, so the statistics are probably not accurate. It might be much closer to 60 or 70 billion at
I was,
this
yeah,
point
that's
annually.
70 billion is the number that I've heard recently, which What's fun about that number as a statistic is it's almost equal to the size of the wedding industry. So it's super industry that the
Sure.
wedding industry as a market or as an industry and as a vertical is equal size to the industry of divorce. And it's also very interesting when you're outside of it. You said something at the beginning, which I think is really relevant to people, as relevant today in 2025 as it would have been in 1975. We don't train people before they get married or before they commit to relationships on the mechanics and the procedures for unwinding the decisions we're making. So, like, we sell as a culture the party of a wedding, right? Like, you're deciding to get married. It's like a wedding. It's a party. It's presents. It's all of these things. It's happy, happy, joy, joy. It's houses and babies and all of those things. Very few people have the knowledge going into that for what the mechanics are and of how you will be unwinding that. And it's not just divorce, it's also widow if you're widowed, right? Those two situations are where, and it's not totally gender specific, like we always hear this from women, but it happens to men too. It's like a 2x4 to the head. It's like, oh, I don't know how this system works. And family court and divorce, which you're an expert in and I'm not, but it is a system. And if you don't know what's going on or who the players are or the vocabulary or the things, you hear it all the time. You hear it all the time that people get like swept up into it in negative waves. And so much so that it's become like some parts of culture where they make movies like, in the 90s, there was a movie like The Roses, right? It's like a satire about a high conflict divorce. So I think that all of that is very good. So you went into this, you initiate, you're the person who files for divorce. But you think that, like, and did you know people at that time who you knew through social things and that had been divorced? Like, do you have any exposure at all to people you knew, girlfriends who had your age, contemporaries who had gone through divorce?
No, but I do want to just add one sort of caveat to that. Most people go into marriage thinking it's about a dress, a tuxedo, and a party. But marriage is a legal binding contract, and we don't know that. We need to re-educate the young generation that entering into marriage is a legal binding contract. And for whatever reason, if the marriage does not end, and we all go into it hoping and wishing and praying that it does, but for whatever reason, 50% or half of first marriages do ultimately at some point in the marriage end in divorce. And the statistics are worse for second and third marriages, about 63 and 72%. But we do go into it thinking it is just this romantic notion. But if for whatever reason it ends, the only way to sever or untie the knot or untangle the knotted ball of yarn is to enter into yet another legal binding contract known as a divorce. So, and whether you're in a community property state or an equitable division state in the US, and of course, Canada, UK, and every country has its own, shall we say, jurisdiction. But yeah, don't think of it as this, it's not about a dress and a party. If you want to buy a dress, let's just go buy a damn dress and
Right,
have a party.
exactly. You can have the party.
Yeah, I'll buy you the dress. Don't worry about it. So, but it is very, very important. So, yeah, so I am the plaintiff. We were, hoping to mediate. That's a long conversation how that happened. But so yes, I find the attorney. I'm the plaintiff. He's the defendant. Yeah, 8.5 years
So
later.
did you so this is a pragmatic question. You can tell me to buzz off if it doesn't matter. Today, in the state where I live, they want you to try mediation before
It's
you
required
go.
in all 50 states, actually.
Okay. So did you when you the like so the just highlight mechanics, like you hire an attorney, you know you want to dissolve, you
No,
file,
that's
you
not how
don't.
it worked.
Okay, so how did you
So,
so
since the pandemic, the court systems have realized, not all 50 states simultaneously, the value of mandating mediation. But there's three types of mediation: a court-appointed,
Yeah.
private mediation with attorneys present, and private mediation without attorneys present. So let's go back to the traditional model of court-appointed or registered mediators. If you're
So wait,
litigating,
I want to ask what you did.
all right.
Like, I
So
want to ask what you did.
I'm trying to
Okay.
explain what we did because back then it was different.
Oh,
So
okay.
It has evolved because, God, I mean, I'm remarried now almost 8 years and things
Yeah.
changed a lot. So, but back in the day, there were not differential areas of mediation like there are now. So, we decided at the kitchen table that we would mediate. So
Okay.
he said, I found a mediator. And I said, great, awesome. He made the appointment. I remember her name. And it was about a half an hour drive. And we went, drove to the mediator's meeting or a brick and mortar office back when the days before virtual. Everything was actually, you drove places. Remember those days? And there was a big conference table, and her name was Anne. And I remember her. She was very kind. And she said, nice to meet you, Paulette. Nice to meet you. And we both filled out our paperwork. And of course, I had the 1A, which was maybe four pieces of paper, and he had the large one. I had worked part-time on paper for my mom, but the last 6 years I had been a stay-at-home mom and hadn't been working, and I had no access to anything, not even the tax returns, knew nothing. And I kind of liked it that way,
Yeah.
Remember, I let everyone else make my decisions for me. Remember that little, oops, oops.
Yeah.
I did it again, Britney Spears thing. Oops, I did that again. Shouldn't have done that. And then he had the longer form. So she said, here's a pen. Why don't you both take a few moments to fill out this, application? I don't know if she
Yeah.
used it. Yeah.
It's like usually it's like a worksheet. Like
Oh,
they give you,
exactly.
yeah, they give you a
She, I'm
worksheet,
sure
yeah.
she didn't call it a worksheet though. She made
No, but
a little bit
yeah.
more subtle, shall we say. And
Sure.
mine was sort of a demographic, name, address,
Okay.
date of birth, employment, name of children, but basically demographics. And his was all the financials and the business entities and all that. And I filled out mine in, I don't know, 6 minutes. Gave her pen. I said, thank you very much. And he doesn't have the greatest penmanship and didn't really want to fill it out. And he kind of was like scribbling, and he'd kind of look at it. And, I think I went to the ladies' room and came back and got a cup of coffee or water or something. And he still hadn't finished it, then at least made a Boy Scout attempt at filling it out, not picking on the Boy Scouts, but, like honest effort, And he said, I'm going to need to take this home because I don't even know all this information, and I'm going to have to look it up, and I'm going to have to talk to my brothers to help me fill this out. And she was like, okay, that's fine, you can do that. And so we left a $2,500 retainer for the mediation, and we made another appointment a few weeks later to reconvene when the paperwork was filled out, and he never filled it out.
Right. I
And
actually,
so we
I wondered
got,
if you
I
could
got
do
a
that.
letter in
Yeah.
the mail back from her with the retainer, hello, returned.
Okay.
And she sent me a little note and she said, good luck, you're going to need it.
Yeah. So that's actually, that's one of the random factoids I have stuffed away in my brain is that
And it
there.
turns out that she was a friend of the attorney he had already been speaking with.
Oh,
So it
that's
was,
a, it
but then
was a
he said, I found
circular.
him.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was a reason we had to drive so far because it was a friend of the attorney. And I know that because when he was in the shower, I snooped through his wallet and there was a business card with the attorney's name. And on the back of it were all the appointments that he had gone to there. He wasn't even, convoluted enough to hide that. So I already knew. And I said, have you seen an attorney? And because I had not seen
Okay.
an attorney. I would tell you, I have no secrets. So,
No, I
and
believe you.
And he said no, and I said, "Are you sure?" And he goes, "Paulette, I haven't seen anyone." And I said, "Do you want to know her name?" And
Because
I
you had
said
already
her
known.
name because I knew it was a woman.
Yeah.
And he stormed out of the room.
And so that's how it escalates. Okay, so you're talking to him at this time. You're like, I
No,
want
we
to get
live in the same
divorced,
house.
and you're living in the same house. So that one of the top reasons that mediation fails is that one of the people will not participate. And so it just doesn't
Absolutely.
work. Like for mediation to work, both people have to come to the table and be willing to do it.
Yes and no. And as a credentialed private family mediator specializing in alternative dispute resolution myself, now after having lived all this and
Yeah.
I'm over it, healed, I'm happily remarried and all. But it is possible if you can frame the mediation that the person that doesn't want to cooperate, feels entitled and exploitive and lack of empathy. Those are the three E's, that they will benefit from mediation more than their spouse will benefit, and that they will be harmed less than their spouse will be harmed. If they believe that prep mediation will benefit them, they will engage. Now, they may not be willing to disclose any and everything, but that doesn't mean you can't create a settlement offer. So there's some strategy to that, but it's not quite as black and white as that. You can still benefit from mediation even if one or both parties are chip on their shoulder.
So you end up going to court, and this takes a decade of your life. And you say that this process changed everything about your life.
Everything.
And so tell me more about what that means.
Well, the psychological, mental, emotional, physical, sexual, spiritual side of marriage, not the judicial, legal, financial, residential, lending, insurance, and taxes and co-parenting side of marriage. But if you go to the woo-woo side or the emotional side, I changed everything. My diet, my lifestyle, the people I hung out with, slowly. It was an ex exfoliation of the soul and of the body and the mind. I became an ERYT 500, an experienced registered yoga teacher with over 500 hours of training. It's now 2000. I became a macrobiotic cook. I started studying cooking and eating and acid and alkaline and lifestyle. I studied Ayurvedic, lifestyle. I became a birth doula, a lactation consultant. I really studied life and people. I became a constant learner. So I changed every aspect of my lifestyle. I still shaved my legs. I didn't wear tie-dye boho bell bottoms and hang out in Harvard Square. And, I'd still, was me. I never was fake about who I was, but I never took the time, nor did I want to take the time to understand more about what made me happy. And I delved into that as a person. And then on the other side, I learned everything I could about the judicial system, finances, real estate, mortgages, taxes, health insurance, co-parenting, guardian ad litems, everything on the spreadsheet side of divorce. I was a, copious note taker, as my attorney said, and I became an asset to the firm and really took a ownership of understanding how I got where I got. And it ended up becoming a very rare situation where literally hundreds at the time of people started to reach out to me. Because of the other careers I'd had, I hung out with a lot of women, ballet, modeling, yoga, babies, breastfeeding, you get cooking, like I knew a lot of chicks, and they reached out to me. I got letters, my doorbell rang. I was teaching yoga teacher trainings at the time and birthing, and the conversation would usually start with, "Are you okay? Why is this taking so long? I thought he was a good guy." Like, it was always like this mystification. But I knew that every conversation, when there was a reach out, it started to end with, "Can you help me?"
Okay, so we're going to come back to that in a second because I think that there's a so you I mean it sounds like I mean this was a huge part of your life and I can see how you were it was you there was your choice was to either be swept along by the court proceedings or become an expert in the process for yourself. And that makes sense to me. At some point though, you like actually like sep you like it ends and you move.
Yes, it did end as far as the court proceeding, and then there are 4 years of appellate court.
Okay, so but
But
after you get your
then,
first judgment, you're like, all right, thank you, and I'm out of here for at least a little while. And that's when you moved to Belize, I think, I guess.
no, I did not move to Belize until the appeals process was over.
Okay, so I have the
That
timeline.
opportunity hadn't even reached my radar or heart at the time. I had every intention of staying in Massachusetts, Until the children were, and by now they're all adults,
That's what I was going to ask. So when you
my
moved to
children weren't
Belize, they were
babies when
adults.
we divorced. So
Yeah.
at that point, they were all, two were in college and one was about to be. So no, I started traveling and speaking at events and really learning a lot about becoming an entrepreneur. Because I started my own registered yoga school and
Okay.
then yoga teacher trainings and retreat centers. And then, so I started studying more about not just having a brick and mortar ballet school because I didn't want to do that. Please don't make me wear tights. So I wanted something different and I couldn't quite envision what that was. So I started traveling more. And of course, I'm allergic to snow. Anger towards the weather in Boston, but I hate it. And that was one of the things that made our marriage very uncomfortable too, is because I didn't want to stay in a cold climate. And he didn't really either, but he was kind of married to his family's business, which is, having to do with cold weather. So I was kind of trapped in this cold weather, like dreary, gray, bone chilling, raw, horrendous weather, winters that last from, November to May, and there are summers or it they anyway, it's just not my idea of a good time. So there was always this angst about, when the kids get older, I would want to move. And that was just, wasn't going to happen. So I was really excited about the opportunity to travel. I had never really traveled as a young girl. I had only traveled in the country and only been to the UK once with my parents at 20. So I always had this yearning to travel and adventure and write and teach and coach and mentor and all the things I'd been doing with yoga and ballet and, modeling. And I'd always mentored young women and I enjoyed it, witnessing them blossom. So as I started to uncover my own passions, which I didn't know what they were. I ended up being offered a position to run, own, direct, and manage a 2,600 square foot aerial yoga teacher training and retreat center in Belize.
Oh, beautiful.
So I signed a 2-year contract with the hotel resort for 2 years. So I ended up selling everything. This is after the divorce was final, and the appeals process was final, and the settlement was over, and the kids were all, adults and situated. And so I moved to Belize and lived there 3 years. So that was after the divorce was final. And then, that's a long story, but ended up transitioning back to the States, and that has really just become sort of an investment or a place where we go and visit.
Yeah, so I think it's very interesting though, because it is a physical representation in your life, a change that is so dramatic and obvious to outsiders that you were
Oh, everyone
shifting.
thought I
And
was crazy. Like,
yeah, and
what
it's a
is she
really,
smoking?
you're really doing something different and moving you out of the geography of where the other part of your life was. You come back, you are in the South, you're building a new life. Even though this is like a really, really dramatic, high conflict, litigated divorce, it doesn't turn you off of relationships forever. You do go on, and we don't have to go in detail with this, but just a footnote in your life, you remarry and you sound very happy in your relationship. It's to me as an outsider. So you live in the South now. Tell us a little bit about your life today, the current stuff that you're doing and what you do.
Well, I figured out that divorce is a big problem, and I wanted to be a disruptor. It irritated me, dare I say, it pissed me off. That's a Boston phrase. To see so many people destroy their lives, allow the judicial legal system destroy their families and their finances and take over. I didn't know there was an option. I mean, we tried it. We tried it,
Yeah,
right? It's
it
like
sounds like you
we
tried
gave
it.
it a good college try, as my dad used to say, right?
Yeah.
But there's it's and I'm changing it. I decided to call my attorney. I said, I don't know what to do, but people keep reaching out to me. Should I go to law school? And he, in his very Boston accent, he's very tall and bald and broad. And his name is Martin. And when you're from Boston and your name is Martin, it's Maddie.
Okay.
So I said to Maddie, you have to say it like that, or he doesn't, what should I do? People keep reaching out to me and asking me for help. And he goes, Polly, you owe it to give back. You think like a judge. You act like a lawyer, but you feel like a therapist. And a tear rolled down my cheek.
Okay.
And it was a longer conversation,
Yeah, yeah.
the gist of it. And I did not go to law school, but he introduced me to a woman named Deborah Block, and she was kind of leaving the industry. She was probably one of the first divorce coaches from Concord, Massachusetts. I just sort of studied and said, wait. There's like people help. I'm like, how come I didn't have one of these? Like, hello. I did a tremendous amount of education and training and certification and mentoring and interning, which led me to become a credentialed private family mediator specializing in alternative dispute resolution. And I'm a certified divorce coach, which helps one of the parties if they're litigating through high conflict antagonistic cases that typically go to trial and even appeals court. And I'm the director of coaching and case management for a company called Divorce Right, which matches employees with EAP programs with the right divorce professionals so they can keep up their productivity at work. I founded Red
Wow.
Divorce Academy, authored number one best-selling book, workbook, audiobook, and soon to be released Better Divorce Blueprint. And I host the Better Divorce podcast. I speak every day. I coach every day. I mediate 6 to 10 cases a month based on how complicated they are, whether they need me 1 month, 3 months, or 6 months. I mediate privately so that people can avoid court, save an average of $40,000 to $70,000 in unnecessary legal fees, divorce swiftly without ever stepping foot in a courtroom with grace and dignity and wisdom.
So you dropped a number in there that I have heard many, many times that I'm just going to call back out because people don't often believe me. Like, I mean, I'm not the person who's an expert, but I've read this and I've seen it. And it's one of the things that I think that does shock people and should shock people, right? So we know that weddings are expensive. That's like a thing that we know. But I think
Sure.
that most people don't realize that the cost of a divorce in the United States is between $40,000 and $70,000.
And that's an average because
Yeah.
if you take
Well,
the
that's
global
important because
average.
like if you like if it's an average, that means there's a lot that are significantly more than that. Like
Sure. I mean, if
and
you
less.
take the average billable
Yeah.
hour, like billable fee, whether that be $300 an hour, $400 an hour, $500, the lowest I'm hearing now is about $175, $200 fresh out of law school. Don't know what they're doing, just coming on. And then, of course, New York City, Boston, LA, Miami, we're talking 675, 700. Right.
Yeah.
So let's just go with that. Math isn't exact, my dear, at a good time. Let's be conservative and say it's $300 an hour, where the average billable monthly amount of billable hours is 10. So if you take $300 an hour times 10 months worth of billing, that's $3,000 a month for spouse A and $3,000 a month for spouse B. Now we're up to $6,000. Now the average litigated case is somewhere between 8 and 24 months. Let's just take 12 for an average. So you take $6,000 a month times 12, 12, 24, 36, 48, 60, that's $72,000. Just on average, some of
Yeah.
them are going to be longer, some will be younger, younger,
Shorter.
shorter, but younger probably too. But that's astronomical. And
It's
it really
astronomical. It's a lot
makes me
longer. Yeah.
angry.
And
Yeah.
you can't, like, it's like you live this, but while it's going on, you're stuck in this tornado stasis of like trying to resolve something in your life, which, whether that's like, standing in line, that sensation of being stuck in a situation you can't escape. That's not pleasant if that situation is standing in line at the grocery store at an amusement park. When you're talking about like every facet of your life, like, the resolution of a marriage situation, that's stressful. That's really stressful. So I want to thank you for sharing all of that about your story because I think it is a provocative tale of preparation and awareness that people can take into their own lives and benefit. You do have a special offer for the listeners, a free digital version of your book and your workbook, which is at betterdivorceacademy.com. I want to
Yes.
thank you very, very much for that generous offer, Paulette. One of the things I love about your story is that everybody in your family appears to have the same name. That's one of the I love that. All right. Are you ready for the final three questions?
Sure,
The
bring it
fun
on.
ones. Let's do it. All right. A lot has changed about so many things in the last decade, and one of those things is how we watch TV and movies. When is the last time you went to a movie theater to see a movie, and do you remember what you saw?
It's been a while. Yes, I think I don't even remember the name of it, but the last movie I remember seeing in the theater would have been Lincoln.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that was a while ago. All right. Very good. I love that
It's been a
question.
while,
Yeah.
but I
All
loved it.
right.
It was very good.
Very good. So, did you as a child have a favorite board game? And if so, what was it?
Oh, not really. We weren't board
Okay.
game people, but as a little girl, I loved Candyland.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It
As
was
a
fun.
Candyland, I have fun memories of Candyland as a child when I played it. And then I have like what is low grade chronic PTSD from playing it with four children over 25 years. Like, I mean, it's just like that trouble, like Monopoly. It's like, you know, if we're going to get it out, I'm like, all right, I have to get my mind ready. I can do this.
Well, my children were jocks and still are. So when they were outdoors playing sports, they spent very little time in the house. Chinese checkers, we would try to play that, jock
Chinese checkers.
analysis. But they weren't really into board games. We
So,
bought them.
yeah.
They played with them once and said, "That's boring."
Candyland is like, I mean, just anyway, it's fantastic. Everybody should
It's
play.
just
It's
very
super fun.
visual,
It's
right?
very
It's
visual.
very visual.
It's not engaging intellectually as much when you're 30 as it is when you're five.
Exactly. When you're five,
It's
it's fabulous.
fabulous. All right. If I invited you over for dinner and offered to make you your favorite meal, what would you ask for?
Well, my husband and I are plant-based,
Okay.
so it would probably be any salad you want to whip up.
Fantastic. All right. I love it. That's it, Paulette Rego. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
It's an honor, and thank you for doing this work, Amy. This is a wonderful message and a great service that you're offering to so many people that need help.
Thank you. Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.